All right, welcome back everyone to the Quill Inquiry podcast. My name is Brandon Hall. As always, I am joined today by my wonderful co-host, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you, Brandon?
I'm doing really good, especially seeing good. That we have a returning face on Quill Inquiry for the first time, I believe. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic, Brandon. And both you and Ash, thanks for having me back on.
Yeah, for sure. For anyone who hasn't caught your last episode, why don't you go ahead and get us up to speed on who you are in the writing world?
So in the writing world, surprisingly enough, in the real world also. So I'm Ben Shankman. I am an urban fantasy author and also an audiobook narrator. So yeah, that's primarily my shtick.
Very cool. Well, we're excited to have you on to talk about some exciting new releases from you, and many other things as well. But before we get into all that, Ben, what have you been up to since your last episode on Quill Inquiry? You've been reading any good books lately, watching any good movies?
Oh, I mean, I've been reading a lot and watching a lot. How long has it been?
A year, I think.
I want to say you were on last year. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I had two or three books out the last time that I was on.
I think it was two.
It was two. So yeah.
Yeah.
I've been up to a lot, and we can get into that. But as far as like the what I've been like consuming for media, I had been rereading a bunch of Charles DeLint, who's one of my favorite urban fantasy authors. He's an inspiration for my latest release, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I tore through Dungeon Crawler Carl, which I think I actually mentioned that I had started reading when we were on last time.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
So yeah, I listened to the latest audiobook. Maybe that was a couple months ago. I slogged through, Wind and Truth from Brando Sando. And I'm working on some indie stuff. I just read Mushroom Blues, which was a finalist for SPIFBO 10 by Adrian Gibson. And I'm currently trying to get through By a Silver Thread by Rachel Aaron. Mm. But I have opinions about the audiobook. And so I'm having a hard time.
Gotcha. Yeah, there's a couple in there that are on my TBR. Mushroom Blues is one. I've had that on there for a while. And then Dungeon Crawler Carl, I always get stuck on that when I'm trying to speak the title out loud. But that one has been interesting for me because it's recommended so often, but I'm not generally a fan of like progression fantasy or lit RPGs. So I don't know if it'll be for me, but then I hear people who say the same thing say they really enjoyed it. So it'll be interesting to see how I react to that one specifically. But yeah, it sounds like you've been pretty busy, aside from writing, consuming stories as well. So that's always good to hear. What about you, Ash? Have you been reading or watching anything as of late?
We've just been making our way through the classic Halloween movies the last few weeks, obviously. The Thing, my partner Ross had never seen it before. And that was fun to rewatch. It's been a while for me as well. And it happens, like, I don't know if you guys have seen The Thing, but it takes place in the Antarctic in the first week of winter, but there's a lot of daylight happening. Mm-hmm. And that's like my number one pet peeve, because I'm like, polar night, it's that there's no sun ever, so it's like the first thing and I'm like, oh, it's never light out. Anyway, so we've been watching a lot of that. Been reading some advanced copies of books that just came out this week, a lot of 3s and 3.5s, and I just got reached out to review Ava Reed's newest book coming out next year, so that's lots of stuff in the queue. What about you, Brandon? You reading, watching, listening?
Yeah, the physical books I'm reading at the moment are both nonfiction recent releases. One is The Romans. I'm trying to read the author's name from over here, but I cannot get it. It's a recent release. Comprehensive Roman history book. So very, very fun for me. And then the other one is The 200 Years War by Michael Livingston. Oh. So reading both
Nerd.
Of those at the moment. Yeah, I had to take a break from fantasy because like the last five books I read were all like in the same vein. Obviously, fantasy is my favorite genre, but, you know, I need a break sure. now and then. Mm-hmm. And I say that, but I'm also listening to the audiobook for Crossroads of Ravens from The Witcher. Mm. So it's not as much of a break as I intended, but when I saw that was out, I had to use my Audible credit to get it. So
yeah, feel that.
And I'm still trying to make my way through Alien Earth. I know I'm like the world's slowest TV show consumer. I don't mm-hmm. know why. I get through like 30 minutes and then I'm like, I need to get up and do something. So,
yeah. It's like, I feel like a lot of shows now do a lot in like an hour and 45 minutes. And sometimes it can just be a little too much and you're just like, yeah. I just need to walk away. It's like too much information overload, I guess is the best way to put it. So.
Yeah. I'm a huge Alien fan. It's a recent discovery of mine. Cause it was, I've never watched the films until like, I think last year when Romulus came out and then I binged all of them and I absolutely love it. So Alien Earth, the show, I really enjoyed the show so far. I'm just taking my time getting through it for those reasons.
Well, nice.
Well, with all of that out of the way, Ben, I think we can go ahead and get into the the interview. We like to start with that little icebreaker. So thanks for indulging my little question there.
Of course.
So aside from reading books and watching movies, what have you been up to when it comes to writing and narration since your last Quill and Query episode?
So the last time I was on Quill and Query, I had published the first two books in my The Devil You Know series. So just because, you know, we can do this. So we've got My Boss is the Devil, which was like mm-hmm. one of the original things that I was on to talk about. But then in June of last year, I put out Dueling Shoulder Angels, which is book two. And so those had come out now. So basically a year ago, so October of last year, I put out the third book in the Devil You Know series, which is called Too Many Gods in the Kitchen. And so that continues the story. So book one is about Nick and the devil. Book two is about like Nick, Amy, and we introduce God. Book three introduces a third protagonist and is where we start moving outside of like the Abrahamic pantheon. So, you know, now it's not just God and the devil, but also some others. Also in October or November of last year, I released the first audiobook of My Boss is the Devil. Subsequently, then in July of this year, I released book two, the audiobook of Dueling Shoulder Angels. Now, I narrate the first book entirely because it's one POV. The second book, I narrate Nick's POV, but Amy, the goth witch supporting character, becomes much more of a secondary main in book two. And my partner, Katya, actually voices Amy's chapters. So we did that one together. So that was released in July. In the meantime, I also have other things that have been going on. So I wrote two books in the interim. I spent probably about 6 months in the query trenches because apparently I hate myself. And so those had been like in the can since early this year.
Okay.
I also took part in the Inkfort Publishing Derby. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Inkfort Press annually put out it's a derby. It has a maximum of 100 entrants because there are 100 pre-made covers and titles with a pen name attached, and you rank the covers, and then, you know, in random order people get selected, and then you get your first choice, and then on downward based on what's available. So like if I am first picked, I get my number one choice. If I'm second picked and the first pick took my number one choice, I get the number two choice, and so on down to like 100 people. And so I actually co-authored a book for the Inkfort Publishing Derby. And I'm going to tell you here, it's been a secret up until now, and we're technically not announcing it until November 1st. But if you can if you and the entire audience can keep a secret, me and I don't know if you're familiar with AJ Poppy Alexander's.
I don't believe so.
They're a fantastic indie author. They wrote Not Your Mountain and Not Your Bargain. And then also they have another book that's attached to them. I don't think they've announced it yet. But we wrote this really fun, really light progression. And when I say progression fantasy, it's like in the loosest terms. Yes. So Brandon, you might still like it.
okay.
It's called Underleveled.
Gotcha.
And yeah, so we put that out. That was actually published in September.
Oh, okay, cool.
And that's great. Then this month, I put out my latest book, which is Let Sleeping Gods Lie.
And that one just came out yesterday, right?
Yes. Right. Yeah. Awesome. You are, in fact, number one on my release like party tour.
Yes.
So
very cool.
It's
an honor
to
be
for that.
The first podcast appearance.
Amazing.
So yeah, the answer is also, I've been doing a lot.
Yeah, very busy.
It sounds like it.
No kidding. That's so exciting. Congratulations on all of literally so many accomplishments since we last saw you. I think that's a testament to your work ethic in ways that I know Brandon and I are trying to hone in because we're taking so long getting our stuff written. But that's so exciting.
And I'm sorry, Brandon, you were going to say something. I cut you off.
Yeah, I lost my train of thought. So I will,
gone
if it
forever.
Comes back to me, we'll circle back to it. But I was just going to, aside from that, I was just going to say thank you for that exclusive piece of information as well. I think that's a first in Quill and Query history. So you heard it here first. Ash, did you want to go ahead and pick up the next question?
Yeah. Okay. So actually, before we go in with the other questions, I have like a follow-up question to you mentioning that you did your audiobook for the first novel, and then you had your partner come in and help. And it's a two-part question. One, while you were doing your audiobook for the first book, did you want to go back immediately and like rewrite as you were reading out loud your own work? So that's question number one. And then question number two is, what was it like working with your partner in a very like, I don't know, creative endeavor? So that's part two.
Okay. So part one. So here's the good news. All of my books, I read aloud. Mm. So like part of my own editing process is the first thing that I do after I'm done writing the book is I put it down for like a week, mm-hmm. and then I read it aloud to my partner, Kat. Mm. And so I find most of the weird cadence problems during that pass because mm-hmm. I think I mentioned this honestly, like in the pieces of advice for new authors, I think I may have mentioned that reading your books aloud is like one of the most important things that you can do because mm-hmm. nothing will tell you that you have a crazy run-on sentence, like running out of breath, like halfway through it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I find most of the problems there. So there were a couple things. I actually found like one or two typos that I did fix.
Mm.
But otherwise, like I didn't have anything where I was like, oh, I hate that. I gotta fix that. So luckily, no. And working with my partner was fantastic, if a little stressful in that it's something that involves like a production schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate putting pressure on them for things, but at some points I had to, in that it was, I really would like to get this published before July. So yeah. If you can, and like, I still edited the whole thing. So like, yes, they went through and they recorded and then they did their own like proofing to make sure that mm-hmm. the chapter sounded the way that they wanted. But then I still had all the editing and mastering ahead of me. So like, I needed it in my hands at some point. So yeah, it was great. I mean, also they have such an amazing voice.
Hmm.
And if you give it a listen, like they are so good for audiobooks. And, but I will tell you the only audiobooks that they're interested in narrating are mine. And that's only because they're committed at this point.
exclusive. Like,
if I gave them an out to not do this anymore, I think they would like be, they would, okay, good. I'm it's stressful to them in a demand kind of way.
Sure. I can imagine.
Understand.
Yeah. Well, great.
Is there ever a night where you were like date night surprise and you leave them down the just, recording booth?
Just like date yeah. night. It's you in the chair. That's the other thing is like, I'm not, covetous isn't the right word, but like I am protective of our time together because we don't always get a lot of time together. So I definitely apologized a few times where I was like, I know I really want to like spend time and do this thing, but I also know that this is like the only night you have this week to like record something.
Sure.
So yeah, it's no surprise. Like you're going to sit in front of the mic kind of time though.
Yeah. It makes sense.
Well, tell us a little bit about your recent release. I know you held it up. It has a very interesting cover. I'm curious as to the story behind
the raccoon
furry friend on the front there. Tell us a little bit about Let Sleeping Gods Lie.
Who doesn't love a raccoon? Like, honestly.
I don't know.
So Let Sleeping Gods Lie is a new standalone / series starter. Like, I leave the end pretty clear that there's going to be follow-ons. I just haven't written any of them yet. But it is disconnected from The Devil You Know. It still happens in New Haven, Connecticut, but think of it as another alternate reality New Haven. And one fun thing that I do think I've managed to do, because my next book that's going to be coming out is also another alternate reality New Haven. I'm like, I
multiverse.
Always, yeah.
Multiverse
it
New
is.
Haven.
It is. It's multiverse New Haven. But I managed to use different parts of the city. So the books don't feel the same. Like, yeah, in this book, the main character's name is Corbin Pierce. Also, in this book, people get last names, as opposed to my other books, where most people don't get last names. And no one's ever called me out on it, and I hope they never do. But yes.
Well, so, now they will, since you've brought it up.
So yes, yeah. in this AU New Haven, people have last names. But Corbin, like, goes to the New Haven Green, but it doesn't feel the same as the Green when Nick goes to the Green, because, like, it's different. It's a different experience. And like Corbin lives in a different part of New Haven, spends time, you know, in the next town over, Hamden. So like I tried very hard to disconnect them enough geographically, even though they're in the same city. So Let Sleeping Gods Lie follows the journey of Corbin Pierce, who is effectively a spiritual environmentalist. The funny comp log line I use, it's Harry Dresden meets Indiana Jones in Leigh Bardugo's ninth house, but works for Greenpeace.
That's amazing.
So he's not a wizard for hire, but he's like a spiritual magical activist. And the magic system is something I've gotten a lot of feedback on that people find novel or unique in that it's tied to the natural world. It's kind of animist in that everything possesses a magical or spiritual energy. And only certain people with the talent to do so can bridge that gap between the world. It also is heavily influenced by indigenous myth and indigenous folklore. And indigenous folklore has the spirit lands, which is like where the spirits reside. And the way that I have it in my books is effectively, think of it as like an overlay, in that if you can open a second set of eyes, you can see not just the world that we're in, but the spirit land beyond it, which is more like an idealized pre-industrial version of where you are. And so this is the story of Corbin Pierce in his goal to protect the indigenous, you know, magical flora and fauna that is being displaced by colonization and urbanization. There's a secret cabal of high magicians related to one of the not so secret societies in New Haven who take from the world rather than utilize their own energies and protect it. So it's that, it's the dichotomy of trying to protect the world and only use your own natural resources versus stripping the world of its energy for your own purposes. It's a very anti-capitalist, anti-industrial message throughout the book.
Very cool. That's excellent. Sorry, I was just going to see if you wanted to handle the next question we had following up on the last one.
Sure. So obviously you are well-versed in writing novels at this point. Was there anything that you did differently or enacted differently or changed about either your process or your style going into this new book / potential new series?
There was more research in this book because, again, I want Corbin isn't just an activist. He's also an anthropologist or an archaeologist. So he's a community college professor. So I use his class, which he teaches effectively like History 102, which includes Indigenous studies. And I use that as a platform to have some discussions around the hardships of the Indigenous tribes and how that's affected things and connections there. So there, I have a bunch of books now, not just like myths and folklore, but also just history of the area. It's based heavily on a specific myth of the Quinnipiac tribe, which is, it's the legend of Hobomok, and Hobomok is like a great like giant spirit. Who technically has fallen asleep. If you look at, if you look for the legend of Hobomok, you'll find the legend of Sleeping Giant, and there's Sleeping Giant State Park in Hamden, Connecticut. And that's where the giant has been put to sleep by a great spirit. So it's all tied in together. So yeah, I would just say what's been different. Like I still use a beat sheet. I still am relatively a pantser. But this book was written kind of, I knew the very beginning and I knew the very end, and it was about filling in the middle and a lot of research. I also reached out to a number of Indigenous people to try and get some feedback. I was lucky enough to have correspondence with one of the clan mothers of a local Algonquin tribe, clan mother Shoren Piper of the Golden Hill Pagasits, and got a lot of feedback there. One of my other ARC readers is a member of the Anishinaabe tribe. And so I also had a lot of people who just did not have the time to speak with me, and that's always the challenge. I feel like I got enough feedback and treated the material respectfully enough that I could move forward with publishing. Like if I hadn't been able to get anyone to talk with me, I would have just had to change the story because it's not material that I want to screw up.
Yeah, I think that's really, one, I love that. And two, I feel, I don't know if you guys agree, but I feel like we are in this kind of like social, cultural shift right now where some people are wanting to not be so like PC culture and others are wanting to kind of go even deeper and be even more PC, which regardless of what camp you're in, I don't think it matters for this conversation, but I feel like it's very rare to have an author do that much, I don't know, back end work to make sure that the story is representative of the culture that it's trying to discuss, even if you yourself are not a part of that culture. I don't know if you are or not, but you know, even if you weren't, I don't know. That's a rare thing. And that's like very cool that you would have been willing to change the story. If you hadn't gotten that feedback, I don't think many people would have done that. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Yeah. I myself am not an Indigenous person, and specifically Corbin Pierce is also not. I, in fact, go to great lengths to let the reader know that despite being aligned with the values of, and maybe even having some misrepresented upbringing, because I don't know where y'all grew up, but I grew up in New England where a large percentage of people were surely convinced that they had some kind of indigenous ancestry, even though like this was before 23andMe was a thing. And like, no one actually knew, just, you know, your parents maybe told you that there was some indigenous ancestry back in your family tree, even though, no genetic testing on the planet would support it. And so Corbin actually goes through that, and that's handled very early in the story in his relationship with an indigenous person. So a supporting character named Harriet, I portray as a member of the Golden Hill Pocasets, because I wanted to have representation of an indigenous tribe in the book without writing from that lens. So it's a balancing act. Just real quick on that. I feel like it's incumbent on authors, and especially authors who write from a place of privilege, to not co-opt marginalized voices. Mm-hmm. So I could still very well get a lot of flack for what I did with my book. I did my best to include things respectfully, give credit where it was due, not portray my voice as being from an indigenous perspective. And like, I'm going so far as trying to make sure I'm giving back in that 10% of the profits of this book, assuming that any of it sells, are going to a 501c3 indigenous charity called Not Our Native Daughters, which is trying to solve the missing, murdered, and exploited indigenous women's like crisis.
Yeah, we'll have to link to that in the episode YouTube video, so that if folks, even if they don't buy your book, which they should, if they want to give, they can do that.
By all accounts, it's a good book.
Yes. Please buy the book.
Well, love that you've done all that research and put all that effort into making sure you were handling the material respectfully. We love to see that. With the writing of this book, was there any experiences or lessons from writing your previous trilogy, with the Devil You Know, any lessons from that experience that you carried over into writing this new book?
I mean, as authors, we try to always build on what our last work was. In that, you know, it's not every book is going to be better than the last one. I feel like that does a disservice to authors, this assumption that every book that you write is going to be better than your last one. Like, for example, Poppy and I wrote Underleveled on a deadline, and it is likely not our best work, but it's a fun story, and that's the intention. So, like, you always learn something from what you write, bringing it into the next book. So from my first series, like, there's a lot I learned just about pacing and crafting a story and, you know, things that people liked and didn't like, as far as like the way that I wrote dialogue, and all of that came into how I wrote Let Sleeping Gods Lie. And it was more serious than my last series. You know, it isn't a dark comedy. There's sarcasm and there's humor, but like, it's not the same. So like, I learned a lot about kind of where I wanted to go with this.
Hmm. Okay. If I could explore a little more, especially on the pacing side, because I feel like that's something that myself and a lot of authors who are working on like their first book worry about. So what are some of the lessons you learned about pacing that you would maybe try to, if in your best effort, I guess, explain to anyone like myself who's struggling to get pacing right?
So, I mean, pacing is just, are we telling an effective story? Not all pacing has to be the same. Like, mm-hmm. some people don't like beat sheets because they feel like beat sheets are too formulaic. But the reality is, all a beat sheet is trying to tell you is, are you hitting the major plot points in the arc of telling a story? Do we learn enough? Do bad things, is there a catalyst to what we're trying to experience? Do our characters grow over time? Is there a false high or a false low? Is there a reveal? You know, it's that whole, some people just use a multiple act structure. Some people use the snowflake method. There's a million ways to do it, but like all pacing is am I telling an effective story in a way that is going to engage and keep the reader? One thing I did learn, entertainingly enough, compared to my first series, is not all readers will like you changing the pace of your stories. So The Devil You Know as a series is I'm going to quote Curtis from Reader Side Quest. It is a not so cozy urban fantasy in that it's got cozy elements to it. Maybe the pace is a little bit slower than a standard urban fantasy. And then I wrote Let Sleeping Gods Lie saying, I want to write an urban fantasy. And when I say by the book, I just mean like a more solid magic system with faster pacing, tighter storyline. And I did that. And some of the feedback that I've seen in the early reviews are, I had trouble with the pacing. And I think what that ended up translating into what I heard specifically from some readers was it was too fast paced for them.
Mm.
It is not too fast paced for an urban fantasy novel, because I've had other readers and other readers who are authors say, no, your pacing is in fact, some people said your pacing is still kind of slow for an urban fantasy, but it's faster than your other books. So like, interestingly enough, I think I have this cross section of like a more cozy crew who like the slightly more paced introspective stuff compared to like a faster paced urban fantasy. So, you know, just know the story that you want to tell, and then just make sure you're hitting the high points, because you'll know that you're not pacing your story right if you have, like, if it's nonstop running or if it's nonstop laying on the ground, something is wrong, right? It's not, you can't just flatline one or the other. You have to give them ebbs and flows. It's a sine wave. It's not a asymptotic curve.
Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds. So I lost my train of thought with that, but I appreciate the insight into pacing, because I do for A Knight of Knives, I am trying to stick closely to like a three act structure. My worry is whether I can nail it, and if it, like, how the reader is going to react to how things are paced. But I got some great insights from you there, so I appreciate that.
Can I add one thing there? I didn't know what a beat sheet was when I wrote the first book, but one of my early readers who is a fan of beat sheets said, your book mostly follows the Save the Cat, like, beat sheet structure, except for these points. And so like you don't need to have the beat sheet in mind when you write the book, but when you're revising, like when you're going through the book the first time after you're done writing it, if you want to say, how tight is my storyline, you can take your three act structure and just as you're reading through your work, check, you can use it as a checklist to say, oh, there's my catalyst, and it's roughly where it should be. Oh, there's my Dark Night of the Soul, roughly where it should be. And so like, you don't have to use it as a planning tool. You can always use it retroactively to kind of see how you did.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. I guess I didn't really think about that approach.
I feel like I struggle, like if I were to use a beat sheet or like, you know, a Save the Cat or whatever, they're helpful for sure. I would just get too obsessed with making sure they hit in the right moments, or like, again, worried about pacing too much versus just at least first draft telling the story. But I also, on the other hand, struggle. I'm like, am I not being structured enough? Am I being too long-winded? Which is always my fear, that, you know, Brandon knows this. I can wax poetic forever if I need to. So yeah, that's always a concern I have too. So it's good to know. It's not that it's good to know, but it's good to hear that like the advice can be on the opposite end of like, finish your story and then use that as like a grading sheet almost of like where you are. So yeah, that's really helpful.
Yeah. And it seems intimidating at first, but I'll say like I've written, you know, how many books have I written? 6 books so far. And mm-hmm. I'm writing my 7th. Like I'm writing the 4th book of The Devil You Know right now. I'm mostly done with it. I am at 80,000 words out of a planned original 80,000 words, probably going to be more like 85 to 90,000 words.
Nice.
And now that I'm writing my 7th book, I used a beat sheet and then like I kind of forgot about it. And so like, is it going to match up? I don't know. Like it's it's intimidating the first time that you do it. Mm-hmm. But once you play with it, like you'll be able to use it as it, they're signposts. They're not even necessarily guardrails if you don't want them. It's am I at the right elevation? You know, it's an elevation marker at best sometimes.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. So in this new world that is not New Haven, but it is also New Haven and a different New Haven, you know, I remember you talking last year about being inspired by these indigenous folklore. Was the sleeping giant one like the main one that kind of triggered this idea for you? Like talk more about how you got to this inspo to use indigenous folklore as like the focal point.
Yeah. So I went to college in New Haven and I hiked Sleeping Giant a fair bit. And my friend Lori Nielsen, she's just to plug her for 2 seconds, she's actually publishing her debut novel in 2 days. On the 30th, oh, nice. her debut novel comes out. And we went to college together. And I said to her, hey, wouldn't it be cool if something having to do with this book with regard to the legend of the sleeping giant? And she was like, oh my God, yes, you absolutely need to write that story. And then bam, I wrote that story. So yeah, it is entirely inspired by the legend of the sleeping giant. And that's it. I don't know how much more to say about that. It is absolutely inspired by that. And then like the magic system is inspired by, you know, that again, trying to hold closer to a lot of the indigenous beliefs as far as like stewardship of the land and things like that.
I'm assuming that you just love New Haven, that like that's why all of your locales for your books kind of take place in these alternate, which is great. I feel like not many authors like love a place so much that they continue to imbue it in their work. But is that the case for you?
Yeah. So you're right. If you write urban fantasy, you have to pick an urban place, mm-hmm. and it could be anywhere, but we got a lot of wizards in Chicago already. And I don't know enough about Chicago, and like write what you know is such common advice, mm-hmm. but it's so true. I knew a lot of New Haven, like the back of my hand. In fact, I've gotten back into going to New Haven as like my old stomping grounds. And so I love the city. It's got everything. It's got all kinds of food. It's got some of my favorite places. It's got urban architecture. It's got a lot of storied landmarks. It's got libraries and museums. And then it's got a lot of really cool people in it. But yeah, I went to school there. I lived there for a very short period of time, but I lived in New Haven County, like 20 minutes away from it for, you know, the majority of my young life.
Hmm. Very cool.
Yeah. There's one other author I know that does frequently reuse the same city, but it is Chicago. So
it's a big city.
Yeah. All right. Well, Ben, the book is out in the wild. I imagine you did get some ARC reviews ahead of time. So tell us a little bit about what reader reactions have come in so far and what the reception to Let Sleeping Gods Lie has been like.
Yeah, I think so. On Goodreads right now, I think I have 27 reviews, and it's averaging around like 4.3 stars. If I was going to plot a curve, you know, it's the majority is 4-star reviews, which in general is good. For Goodreads, it's great because Goodreads is Goodreads. but the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. I would say in the ARC team, I really only had, like, I had one person who did not finish the book simply because something in the story really hit something very personal for them that they did not want to deal with. Absolutely respect that. And I had one other person that I can't really get into it, but let's just say, like, their opinion on the book did not match any other feedback I had ever gotten from any of my readers. So I'm just going to say the book wasn't for them. Otherwise, people love the magic system. People love the characters. People love the raccoon. The raccoon is inspired from a real life thing. I encountered a fat raccoon in New Haven many years ago. Much in, like, if you read the first chapter, where Corbin meets the raccoon, is really what happened. This fuzzy guy, like, while staring me down, pulled himself into, like, a crack in a wall about this big, because they can squeeze into spaces that are like a tenth of their body size.
Just
trying to get away from me. And that I've held on to that for like 20 years and then wrote a story about it.
It's a memorable experience.
Yeah, that's honestly like a really great name for either like a cafe or a bookshop, the Fat Raccoon.
The Fat Raccoon.
Just like
make
that a part of your like merchandise in the future if you sell any.
I mean, he's a favorite. Like, you know, my friend, people, readers might would say like, you know, Team Scratch forever, because eventually he gets a name. But yeah, the raccoon is pretty central to the story. So yeah, everyone loves the raccoon. They want more of the raccoon. Many of them really like the fast pace. Some people, like I said, some of the feedback was I struggled with the pacing. But I don't actually think they meant pacing the way we talk about pacing. I think they just meant for them, it did not let up in a way that gave them time to absorb the story. But again, respect to that. I don't argue when people say, well, the pace wasn't great for me. It's like, okay, great. But there's nothing I can do to fix that now. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't rewrite the story I intended it to be fast paced, so I'm not going to rewrite it to slow the story down. But also not every reader is going to have the same opinion. Overall, I would just say the feedback's been overwhelmingly positive. And I'm especially happy that people feel like I've done justice to the research needed to handle the cultural material well, and that it feels like I put the care in for that. That's a lot of the feedback that I've gotten also. The feedback that I got initially, like my Indigenous, effectively beta readers, I incorporated some solid feedback from them about the fundamental story that shaped the way that it went. So the story is a better one for having like Indigenous voices reading and giving feedback on the story.
Yeah.
And did you, sorry, go ahead, Brandon.
No, I was just going to say from other authors that I've talked to and I've listened to, they've said kind of a similar sentiment where there's no higher praise for a book you've written really than getting that positive reception from like a group of people you're trying to represent well. So that's got to feel great. Sorry, go ahead, Ash.
Yeah, and sorry, also the dog is being very obnoxious this evening, I keep muting over and over. Yeah, so when it comes to beta reading for something like this, when you are, you know, and we keep asking questions about kind of like the Indigenous component because we haven't had anyone on here that's kind of worked in that field of this genre. You know, are you actively reaching out and asking people to beta read? Are you putting like a call out and seeing who comes, or are you like very specifically going to someone and saying, hey, like, I know you're a part of this community. Would you please like beta read? Like, what does that look like for, you know, for a project like this?
I put out a call for sensitivity readers who had like, who were part of either were Indigenous themselves or had some sort of experience with Indigenous culture. And again, like, I really only got two. I got the clan mother from the Golden Hill Pogacits, who did an early read of the book and provided some feedback. And I had, I think it was Susie from the Anishinaabe, who provided like much more actionable feedback. But again, like I did not get as much response to my seeking that kind of feedback during beta. But again, like I feel like the people that I did speak with and get feedback from were, you can't make every, like, and this is feedback that Shoren gave me, was good luck and you can't make everyone happy. So, sure. Mostly the people that I talked to felt that I handled their culture with respect. Not everyone is going to. Some people are just going to say, I'm a Jewish dude. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be writing anything, having anything even to do like 10 feet away from indigenous culture. And my answer to that is I respect your opinion on that, but not everyone feels that same way. And I'm writing about the history and folklore of a specific area. And so I did my best to represent that well. So yeah, I looked for sensitivity readers and they're hard to find, frankly. Mm-hmm. But like, I didn't put out a giant, like I didn't go blast TikTok saying, hey, if you're an indigenous sure. person, do you want to come read my book? Like I think that was too scattershot for me when I did get some really solid, like individual feedback.
Sure.
Well, I want to pivot away a little bit from this book specifically and ask, what other projects are you working on currently? Now, I know that might tie us back to Let Sleeping Gods Life. As you said, this is a standalone slash potential series starter. So if you are working on more stuff in this world, don't feel like you can't share that as well. But just what's next for your writing journey?
Okay, so one book that I have like ready for ARC reads, if I decide to put it out soon, it's a different book called My Brother's Keeper. And that is actually entirely based on Jewish magic and mysticism. Mm. So I am Jewish, which case in this case, hey, you know, but I also still consulted experts. There's this fantastic person, Adne Sade, who is online at the Jewish Monster Hunter. Like they have a website and they are an absolute treasure and expert when it comes to Jewish mythology, demonology, magic, and mysticism. And they provided a ton of resources. And then also like Alpha read my book and provided feedback on the magic system specifically. In that, so like, cool. I had done some things, and then he was like, well, it really is more like this than that. And so, like, we had a lot of back and forth discourse about different aspects of the book. So, it's another urban fantasy. It's another New Haven, but it's very Jewish. And I say that because that's actually a part of my own culture that, like, I have not embraced in a very long time. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting for me in that regard. So that book is done, and it's, and like, no offense to any of my books, it's the best book I've written so far.
Oh, and that's so great.
I just want it out there. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to, like, I'm going to go through the normal process, but it, so that's upcoming. I'm almost done writing the fourth book in The Devil You Know, which is called A Little Death Among Friends. And that's where it focuses on death, which, spoilers, I am terrified of that topic. And so this book explores a bunch of stuff having to do with that. It's kind of sad sometimes. So that's coming. I feel like that may come out even sooner than My Brother's Keeper, just because it's a fourth in a series. Like, mm-hmm. I can advertise it, but like ARC reads, I can... for people who've read all three books, yes, I'll get a few ARC reads, but for the most part, a fourth book gets released into the wild, and I'm going to hope for the best.
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
And then, you know, that's what I'm writing right now. I'm also going to be starting production on the third audiobook for Too Many Gods in the Kitchen. So that's starting like as soon as I'm done writing book four. And then I also have like a very small amount of the next Corbin Pierce book down, but like I need to go back and revisit that.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you'll have plenty to keep you busy for quite a while there. Just want to say a side note, the some of the inspirations you've mentioned, like using your own Jewish heritage and then also indigenous cultures as well, aren't things that you typically see, at least in my experience, in fantasy settings. So I think it's really cool that you're exploring these more, I guess, underserved areas in the fantasy space, because I feel like with fantasy, we have the tendency to kind of go to the same inspirations and the same the same cultures and stuff. So it's always nice to see a refreshing take on it.
Thank you. I feel like that's where my genre crosses from urban fantasy into magical realism, in that I'm kind of making a niche for myself. Whether the niche exists, I mean, I'm either making it for myself or I'm joining it if it exists. And that's like people who really make their magic based in some kind of reality. And you know, whether that's based on certain religions or based on certain spirituality, it isn't just, and I throw fireballs. It's, you know,
right.
Which actually I make a snarky joke in Let Sleeping Gods Lie about throwing fireballs when Corbin is trying to explain magic to somebody. Thank you. I appreciate that, Brandon.
Yeah, of course. Ash, did you want to handle the next question?
Sure. So this is a question we tend to ask everybody, but what advice do you have for new and aspiring writers, especially since you are at this point like a professional in the self-publishing space?
Sorry, I only laugh because like I have so many irons in the fire. Sometimes it's hard to do I consider myself a professional in the space? Yes, I do. But at the same time, I chide myself for doing it. But like,
we like humble. We like a humble brag. But I think Brandon and I can safely say you are a professional in this regard.
including audiobooks. Like by March, I'll probably have 9 books published. So like I think it's you're right. It's okay. I can claim that.
You can own it.
And maybe I don't know if this is the same advice I gave last time, but like it rings true, and I can tell you it. Know why you want to publish. So like, maybe it's both. Know why you want to write, and then know whether you want to publish. And then when you decide that you want to publish, decide why, because that also can inform what you write. And having as many books out as I do, I can tell you, urban fantasy ain't making money. It's not like you can't make money writing urban fantasy, but let's just say that if I was writing urban fantasy to make money, I would have quit by now. Mm-hmm. But it's the genre that I love, and it's the stories that I have to tell, and it's important to me to tell the stories and to know that readers are enjoying the books. That's what I care about. And so that makes me happy, and I'm publishing because I want to be happy. If I was publishing to make money, I would write romance. It's like I would write romance, dark romance, weird monster romance. There's a lot of money in those things, and I have none of those stories to tell. So when you're figuring out what it is that you want to do, you got to know why you want to do it. Because I see a lot of authors who are like, I just finished my 150,000 word debut epic fantasy and I want to make money. And we're like, oh, honey, no.
Yeah.
No, that's not what's going to happen. And it's not that you can't make money writing epic fantasy. But if you're a debut author with a book that surpasses the word count that traditional publishers and agents want to see, you're going to probably end up in the self-publishing trenches. And then that's a whole different ballgame to, I want to be the next Sarah J. Maas or, Elizabeth Yarros or Rebecca Yarros. I don't know.
Rebecca Yarros.
Her, the Yarros.
The Yarros.
With the, yeah. Her.
Yeah. her.
Yeah, no insult to women. Just it's this particular author.
Sure.
That one.
Yeah.
That so, makes sense. I think you're right, and that a lot of people come in with certain expectations, and then they hit the reality check at a certain point, which thankfully I've hit before publishing anything, so it's I don't have to worry about that. But it's always a good thing to just remind people of, especially as they're coming into the publishing space.
Yeah, and sorry, just one more quick follow up, because this is a conversation I had literally with my friend Lori, who is publishing her debut under our I have an imprint that I run for our writers co-op. That's the Caffeinated Terrier Press, which is what I publish all my books under. And so she's releasing her book under Caffeinated Terrier Press, because when she finished it and she said, well, what do I do now? And I said, and asked her one question, and this is a question you need to ask yourself. So I'm going to look directly at you, the audience. How much do you like rejection? Because if you don't like rejection, then self-publishing is for you. If you like rejection, then maybe consider getting into the query trenches with traditional publishing, because and I said to her, how much do you like rejection? And she said, I don't. I'm like, then you're self-publishing your book. It's just, that's it.
That's the test. Yeah,
that is a good point.
It's a good question.
A lot of rejection to be had there. I'm not speaking from experience, but just other people's experience.
I am. It's nothing but rejection, especially if you write in an unpopular genre.
Yeah, I can imagine.
All right. Well, I do have one little fun question, kind of unrelated to everything else we've talked about, but one last fun question before we turn it over to the audience and get ready to sign off. And that is, if you could read one book again for the first time, forgetting everything you knew, experiencing it again, you know, brand new, what book would you choose?
I'm going to throw this out there just as the first thing that came to mind. Mm-hmm. I would reread Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb.
Mm.
Very cool.
I love that whole series. And it was a great one.
I haven't read it yet. It's on my TBR, but it's on my shelf right now. And I was like, I'm excited once I get through my advanced copies. I think I'm going to pick that one up next. Yeah. I've heard such good things.
Yeah, Robin Hobb is a glaring hole in my reading experience, so I need to pick some of those up. Especially that's one that's recommended all the time. So it's one of those books that's always there that I know I got to get to it eventually.
Mm. Brandon, do we know yours? Have you answered this question before on the?
I don't think I have, but I feel like I have. Like the most obvious answer, it's gonna be a Game of Thrones or The Blade itself. Just because those books, I reread them all the time, but to reread them without any of the prior knowledge that I have now, and just experiencing them again, like the very first time I read them, and all of those revelations and the way it felt to read it the first time, I definitely just have to go with one of those, just because I don't think there's been another book that has matched those for me. I'd say they're pretty tied too. So I could go with either one. Did we get yours now that we're.
The first one that popped into my mind, and then I thought about it too much. So I technically have two, but I'll go with the first one that popped up, and it's Aberrat by Clive Barker. I don't know if you guys know who Clive, but he did Hellraiser back in the day. And he did a bunch of children's novels in the early 2000s and children's novel. Yeah. But they came with little plushies and stuff. Anyway, Aberrat was his three book series about this young girl named Candy Quackenbush who lived in a town where the main export is chickens. Anyway, she falls into
monsters.
Anyway, she falls into this world where every island is a different hour of the day. So there's 25 islands, one which is a mystery hour. And it's one of the most creative, unique stories I ever read. Terrifying, funny, heartfelt. Anyway, I would kill to read that for the first time again. It took my brain. Yeah.
Very good choice. That looks like Nicole was trying to guess ours or something.
Cruel Prince is a good one.
For Brandon and Cruel Prince for S. So
that was a good guess. You got mine. Good guess, Nicole. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think it's just Nicole with us in the chat. So I'll give Nicole a second if she's got any questions for us or for Ben. But Ben, just want to say thanks so much for joining us again on Clue and Query and for being our first repeat guest. And congratulations on the recent release. And of course, if we get any questions when this goes live on YouTube, I'll be sure to send those your way and we can make sure those who missed the live still get their questions answered. But yeah, just had another great interview, and we hope to see many more books from you. Sounds like you got many more in the works, so I don't think we'll be disappointed on that count.
Thank you to both of you. I had a great time. I love that I'm your first repeat guest. I'm happy that I could have enough like stuff to add to something, not just like, I got one more book. It's like, bleh.
Yeah,
I love it.
You've definitely been keeping busy, so that's great to see.
Yeah, definitely.
Ben and Ash, I'll open it up to you guys. Any closing thoughts for the audience before we sign off for the night?
I don't think so, but always keeping an eye out for your work, Ben. Really excited. Oh, looks like Nicole does have a question. This could be our last one for the day.
Yeah, so the question from Nicole, Ben, is the audiobook Indie World any different from the physical publishing? So I think the question, like the indie side of audiobooks, is it drastically different from like the written side of indie publishing?
So maybe you can clarify, Nicole, are you specifically saying like indie audiobook versus indie physical publishing, or like indie audiobook versus trad audiobook? And
I'm thinking it's the former, but we'll see
because she did say physical, so I think that's
yeah. So if it's just indie, so it number one, it costs more. So audiobooks are significantly more of an investment than a book. So physical books, ebooks, whatever. Honestly, I almost don't care how expensive your cover is. Doing an audiobook is more expensive if you're paying to have it done, because you're paying per finished hour. So for every finished hour of audio, so for example, Dueling Shoulder Angels is 6.5 hours long. The SAG-AFTRA minimum rate is $250 per finished hour. You can get narrators for less than that, but just as an average, 200 to 250 is normal for a good narrator. So you're talking, you know, easily 12, you know, at least, for example, that was 6.5 hours. Let's say I got somewhere for $200 an hour. I'm talking still over $1,300 to get the audiobook produced. There are better options. If you are budget conscious, you can do royalty share, meaning if you can get a narrator who will effectively accept 50% of the royalties for the life of the book, some narrators will agree to do that. And that can be done mostly through ACX, which is Audible's exchange. There is one other company that I don't remember the name of right now that does royalty share. But then there are also other audiobook producers like Podium and Tantor and even Soundbooth Theater that did the Dungeon Crawler Carl books. They are more accessible than traditional publishing. So like you can submit your book, even though you're indie published, you can submit to Podium and say, do you want to do an audiobook of my book? And there are a ton of self-published authors who have audiobooks through Tantor and Podium.
Very cool. Super helpful. Aware of those other platforms, so I'll definitely have to check those out.
We could have a whole show just about audiobooks.
Yeah.
We did just have our first narrator interview with Tess Irondale recently. So yeah, we've been learning a lot about audiobook production for sure.
I have a feeling we'll be talking about it more in the future too. So yeah, maybe we'll have you on for a third time to just talk audiobooks.
Happy to.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's going to be it. Nicole, of course, says thank you for that insight into the differences there. So, but yeah, I think that's all we got. That's all. Thanks again, Ben, for joining us. Thanks, Ash, as always, for being such a great co-host. And thanks to Nicole in the chat for being our number one supporter. We always appreciate you. So, and thanks to everyone else who joined us now or in the YouTube recording. Your support means a lot to us, and we're excited to keep watching Clone Query grow.
Thanks, Ben. It's a great time.
Yeah, thank you both.
All right. See you guys.
See you guys.
Bye.